Namaste. Welcome. We're back in the second chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga, the Three Steps of Nature. This essay was published in September 1914. Little revised, it is a wholesale appreciation of all the steps of nature that form the vehicle which we evolve a great consciousness in that reunites us with our real origin, a transcendent reality. The steps of nature are not mistakes, they're not curiosities, they're not chimeras. They are intentionally invested in the base of the universe, and they come out in the process of evolution according to the will of a secret higher nature. Populated in this immense seeming darkness are all the godheads which emerge in the course of evolution. Sri Aurobindo continues here. Moreover, the whole trend of modern thought and modern endeavor reveals itself to the observant eye as a large conscious effort of nature in man to effect a general level of intellectual equipment, capacity, and farther possibility by universalizing the opportunities which modern civilization affords for the mental life. Large conscious effort of nature. So this elevation in matter into living matter and in living matter into mind is part of nature's intention. Even the preoccupation of the European intellect, the protagonist of this tendency with material nature and the externalities of existence, is a necessary part of the effort. It seeks to prepare a sufficient basis in man's physical being and vital energies and in his material environment for his full mental possibilities. By the spread of education, by the advance of the backward races, by the elevation of depressed classes, by the multiplication of labor-saving appliances, by the movement towards ideal social and economic conditions, by the labor of science towards an improved health, longevity, and sound physique in civilized humanity, the sense and drift of this vast movement translates itself in easily intelligible signs. The right, or at least the ultimate means, may not always be employed, but their aim is the right preliminary aim, a sound individual and social body, and the satisfaction of the legitimate needs and demands of the material mind, sufficient ease, leisure, equal opportunity, so that the whole of mankind, and no longer only the favored race, class, or individual, may be free to develop the emotional and intellectual being to its full capacity. At present, the material and economic aim may predominate, but always behind their works or their weights in reserve, the higher and major impulse. So we see here the awakened or awakening individual ensconced, embedded in a society which has also its needs, both individual and society, have legitimate aims and processes. And a balanced individual and a balanced society will achieve a balanced culture, a setting in which a farther evolution might be more possible and can be predicated. So, as he says here, there works or there waits in reserve the higher and major impulse. So, even if we seem to be focused on the external, if we're focused on achieving these things which seem to better our life, what they actually represent are fields and areas in which we can have the inner satisfaction, the inner knowledge, etc., without having to master the external process. The fact that we look for it externally is a sign of something that we should possess interiorly. So, the urge of nature to accomplish this in the mind of the human means that it will be fulfilled. And when the preliminary conditions are satisfied, when the great endeavor has found its base, what will be the nature of that farther possibility which the activities of the intellectual life must serve? If mind is indeed nature's highest term, then the entire development of the rational and imaginative intellect and the harmonious satisfaction of the emotions and sensibilities must be to themselves sufficient. But if, on the contrary, man is more than a reasoning and emotional animal, if beyond that which is being evolved there is something that has to be evolved, then it may well be that the fullness of the mental life, the suppleness, flexibility, and wide capacity of the intellect, the ordered richness of emotion and sensibility, may be only a passage towards the development of a higher life and of more powerful faculties which are yet to manifest and to take possession of the lower instrument, just as mind itself has so taken possession of the body that the physical being no longer lives only for its own satisfaction, but provides the foundation and the materials for a superior activity. So, is mind the true peak? Are we to be satisfied with the intellectual and emotional and aesthetic achievements that we've attained so far and merely move within the orbit of these things? Or is there another possibility? Can we be called to a greater height through a conscious passage that we call evolution? Can those other faculties take possession and manifest? Notice he says here, more powerful faculties. These are faculties not only of illumination, not only of knowledge beyond the circumscribed knowledge of the human mind, but it is a light which has a power. So an intelligence of a greater order that can effectuate itself and not be domiciled, dulled by the impact on the physical. The assertion of a higher than the mental life is the whole foundation of Indian philosophy, and its acquisition and organization is the veritable object served by the methods of yoga. Mind is not the last term of evolution, not an ultimate aim, but like body, an instrument. It is even so termed in the language of yoga, the inner instrument, antahkarana. So, yoga begins, ancient wisdom begins in India with the recognition that mind is not the summit of consciousness, is not the real source of consciousness, but is a medium, a vehicle through which consciousness expresses itself, Very different view. And so, in terms of an evolutionary process, a hidden greater nature could never be satisfied with such a faulty instrument as its acme of perfection. So this inner instrument is there, Anta Karana. And Indian tradition asserts that this which is to be manifested is not a new term in human experience, but has been developed before and has even governed humanity in certain periods of its development. Now, this is a hint at the Vedic age in the past, the age of the mysteries in Greece, the Upanishadic realizations, where there is a realization which summons forth the soul from within and calls down a higher consciousness from above and establishes, at least for a moment, in an illumined individual, in a representative society, a type of humanity which impresses itself so much on the mind of the race, of the human race, that it regards it with great honor and says, "This we must achieve again." Because it touched the earth, brushed against it. We're charmed. We're made to aspire because it has happened, at least in a moment, not in all the terms of the evolution which are now available to us, but there was a sudden revelation of the Godhead in humanity in ages past. Not sufficient to postpone or to disband every effort at evolution. We have still to grow from, as Sri Aurobindo says, the dawns of the past to the noons of the future. He continues, "In any case, in order to be known, it must at one time have been partly developed. And if, since then, nature has sunk back from her achievement, the reason must always be found in some unrealized harmony, some insufficiency of the intellectual and material basis to which she has now returned, some over-specialization of the higher to the detriment of the lower existence." But what then constitutes this higher or highest existence to which our evolution is tending? In order to answer the question, we have to deal with a class of supreme experiences, a class of unusual conceptions, which it is difficult to represent accurately in any other language than the ancient Sanskrit tongue, and which alone they have been to some extent systematized. Several things are interesting about this. First, as we noted when we studied the Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo asserts that the greatest knowledge does not come from the ratiocination, the logical pursuit which the mind uses to gather evidence, to prosecute a point, and to arrive at a conclusion, a very slow and clumsy and imperfect process. Rather, the greatest knowledge is experiential and then expressed in the language of the mind. And what language best captures it? Sanskrit, which in its great origins had the richness of a multi-significance that later in its conventional development faded to some extent. But Sanskrit has the capacity to capture an experience and express it in a way that resonates across many stadia of existence. So we'll see examples of that in coming pages. The only approximate terms, he writes, in the English language have other associations, and their use may lead to many and even serious inaccuracies. The terminology of yoga recognizes, besides the status of our physical and vital being, termed the gross body and doubly composed of the food sheath and the vital vehicle, besides the status of our mental being, termed the subtle body and singly composed of the mind sheath or mental vehicle, a third, supreme, and divine status of supramental being, termed the causal body and composed of a fourth and a fifth vehicle, which are described as those of knowledge and bliss. So he is talking here about the mental vehicle, mana kosha, the supramental being, vijnana kosha, and the bliss being, ananda kosha. Kosha, again, as we said last time, is a word that means container. Vessel. He continues, but this knowledge is not a systematized result of mental questionings and reasonings, not a temporary arrangement of conclusions and opinions in the terms of the highest probability, but rather a pure, self-existent, and self-luminous truth. And this bliss is not a supreme pleasure of the heart and sensations with the experience of pain and sorrow as its background, but a delight also self-existent and independent of objects and particular experiences, a self-delight which is the very nature, the very stuff, as it were, of a transcendent and infinite existence. And since we've studied the life divine from page one to the last page, you know where he's going with this. And he'll say it in just a moment. Do such psychological conceptions correspond to anything real and possible? All yoga asserts them as its ultimate experience and supreme aim. They form the governing principles of our highest possible state of consciousness, our widest possible range of existence. There is, we say, a harmony of supreme faculties corresponding roughly to the psychological faculties of revelation, inspiration, and intuition, yet acting not in the intuitive reason or the divine mind, but on a still higher plane, which see truth directly, face to face, or rather live in the truth of things, both universal and transcendent, and are its formulation and luminous activity. So there's quite a bit there. We should unpack it a little. He's speaking again of an ultimate experience of the nature of reality. And there is a harmony of revelation, that which can reveal truth when it wishes to see, it reveals truth. It has that power not to stop at the appearance, not to merely contact the surface of an object, but to know, to force into revelation the whole of the content of the thing that it regards. Inspiration means the capacity to receive the truth, not outward going, but receptive. Inspiration occurs within you, and it's true, unerring. Intuition, as he said in the Life Divine, a lightning bolt, a ray of light which lights up that which it regards and forces into the field of knowledge the inner truth of that object, of that experience, of that movement, whatever it is that it sees. So in the Veda, of course, there are words, names for these. You know, Ila, the goddess of revelation. Saraswati, the goddess of inspiration. Sarma, the hound who knows how to get to the truth and can follow into the caves of the Panis, looking for the cows and finds the source of light even in darkness. That's Sarma. So, these belong not to the mind. These faculties that we just mentioned can play in the mind and can illuminate the normal human intelligence. We can have moments when we open to revelation or inspiration or intuition. And we all feel that. Suddenly we understand, we know. And there is no bargaining about it. It's unequivocal. But that is just the play of this higher light in the mind. It's not native there. It's not something that we can summon and command and make native to us. So, we have to grow into that. And as we grow into it, we see the truth directly. But not simply in the item that we regard. The consciousness that sees must itself become wide. It can't simply be a small perspective. It must become universal. And even though it may be individual and universal, or a universalized individual, it must be based on transcendent reality. So all these three terms of being, the transcendent, the universal, and the personal, must have an interface in our consciousness as it becomes true. And he continues, and these faculties are the light of a conscious existence superseding the egoistic and itself both cosmic and transcendent, the nature of which is bliss. These are obviously divine. And as man is at present apparently constituted, superhuman states of consciousness and activity, a trinity of transcendent existence, self-awareness, and self-delight is indeed the metaphysical description of the supreme Atman, the self-formulation to our awakened knowledge of the unknowable, whether conceived as a pure impersonality or as a cosmic personality manifesting the universe. So he is referring again to Satchit Ananda, the old Vedantic term for existence, consciousness, bliss. So if we can say something about what is real, we can say that it is. We can say that it is aware of itself, and that its awareness of itself is perfect bliss, delight. We see this term come into existence not in the early Upanishads, although they seem to be in complete accord with this later concept, but in the Nrisimha Uttara Upanishad, 7th century, it's a Vaishnava Upanishad. So, the first appearance of this term is in a devotional text devoted to a person, Vishnu. So it is not referring to an impersonal reality, but its first appearance, Satchit Ananda, is in reference to a great conscious being. It also appears in the Muktika Upanishad, around 4th or 5th century, Common Era, in the Vasudeva, in the Ramo Uttara Tapani, and later, of course, in Sri Lalita Sahasranam, where she is Satchidananda Rupini, that is her form that she chooses, that which is infinite being, consciousness, and bliss. How can that have a form? But if it has a form, she possesses it. So this is a reality that exceeds the compass of the mind to understand it. So we split things into whether it is personal or whether it is impersonal, and perhaps it is both, perhaps it is neither. We can't say, get the experience. Find out what is that Satchit Ananda, and then live in bliss. Live in consciousness. Live in your true nature. He concludes this paragraph by saying, but in yoga, they are regarded also in their psychological aspects as states of subjective existence to which our waking consciousness is now alien, but which dwell in us in a superconscious plane and to which, therefore, we may always ascend. You see, this is a larger picture of what you are than you normally know. You know yourself to be compassed by an ego. You have your own sensations, your own thoughts, and that fellow over there has a different set of sensations, lives in a different body, has a different order of experience. Normally you think of God as being somewhere else, but in fact, your consciousness is always at one with the divine. What you have to do is demolish, to liberate yourself from the structures that imprison you, and recognize that these higher capacities of which we speak in the annals of yogic experience are there already in you. For, as is indicated by the name, causal body, karana, as opposed to the two others which are instruments, karana, this crowning manifestation is also the source and effective power of all that in the actual evolution has preceded it. So karana means to cause. To cause to come into being. Karana means what is caused, what has been done, but who is the one that makes the thing happen? That is the action of karana. Our mental activities are indeed a derivation, selection, and so long as they are divided from the truth that is secretly their source, a deformation of the divine knowledge. So again, whatever is divided, whatever is limited in scope, and lives within those limits, and accepts those limits as valid and real, lives a partial existence. Our sensations and emotions have the same relation to the bliss. Our vital forces and actions to the aspect of will or force assumed by the divine consciousness. Our physical being to the pure essence of that bliss and consciousness. The evolution which we observe and of which we are the terrestrial summit may be considered in a sense as an inverse manifestation by which these supreme powers in their unity and their diversity use, develop, and perfect the imperfect substance and activities of matter, of life, and of mind, so that they, the inferior modes, may express in mutable relativity an increasing harmony of the divine and eternal states from which they are born. So the things that we feel affect from are born of bliss. When we know or cause something to come into being. When we create, we're using the aspect of consciousness force. And when we call upon the truth of our being, we're sitting in Sat. So all of this, as he says, is installed inversely in an involution in nature so that the highest principle, Sat, existence, bases itself in matter. Consciousness, force, and will bases itself in the power of life. And Ananda expresses itself through the power of the soul as it emerges and experiences the world before it. And of course, vijnana is the expression of knowledge. So these are the sevenfold ranges of being that Sri Aurobindo writes about in The Life Divine. Now, it's interesting that he puts this here in the second chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga in 1914. And about 2 years later, finally he gets to say the same thing in The Life Divine after careful preparation. But here he's already recorded that these principles of existence that we have here emanate from that, Sat-Chit Ananda. If this be the truth of the universe, then the goal of evolution is also its cause. It is that which is immanent in its elements, and out of them is liberated. So that conscious being, whose nature is delight, is actually who causes the manifestation of the cosmos. Not an accident. And it is that which is immanent. Immanent from the Latin means to remain in. Indwelling. So it may be there, above in the transcendence, but it is also here. It's as if we're swimming in it. We can't escape it. Everywhere we move, we're inside that divine being that we call Sat-Chit Ananda. And liberated also from the Latin, to set free, to release from restriction. So this is what yoga does for us in completing the course of evolution. The restrictions that are upon us, which we have gladly accepted so that we can evolve in the cosmos and enjoy the world game, we drop one at a time. We drop our ignorance. We drop our mortality, etc., etc. We extend the range and the power of our being. And thus, come back into fulsome union with what we really are. The immanence itself would have no credible reason for being if it did not end in such a transfiguration. But if human mind can become capable of the glories of the divine light, human emotion and sensibility can be transformed into the mold and assume the measure and movement of the supreme bliss. Human action not only represent, but feel itself to be the motion of a divine and non-egoistic force, and the physical substance of our being sufficiently partake of the purity of the supernal essence, sufficiently unify plasticity and durable constancy to support and prolong these highest experiences and agencies, then all the long labor of nature will end in a crowning justification, and her evolutions reveal their profound significance. So if we actually can achieve this, all the possibilities that were present in the cosmos at its birth will come to flower, and the universe will be justified. As Sri Aurobindo writes in Savitri, justify the light on nature's face. So dazzling is even a glimpse of this supreme existence, and so absorbing its attraction, that once seen, we feel readily justified in neglecting all else for its pursuit, even by an opposite exaggeration to that which sees all things in mind and the mental life as an exclusive ideal. Mind comes to be regarded as an unworthy deformation, that a supreme obstacle, the source of an illusory universe, a negation of the truth, and itself to be denied, and all its works and results annulled if we desire the final liberation. This is the mind's experience of that supreme reality. And then, this is all dust. I don't want this anymore. But that Sri Aurobindo will not accept. That he continues. But this is a half-truth, which errs by regarding only the actual limitations of mind and ignores its divine intention. The ultimate knowledge is that which perceives and accepts God in the universe as well as beyond the universe. The integral yoga is that which, having found the transcendent, can return upon the universe and possess it, retaining the power freely to descend as well as ascend the great stair of existence. This is a line that's very reminiscent of something he would write a dozen years later or so in The Mother, Chapter 6, The Double Ladder of Existence. For if the eternal wisdom exists at all, the faculty of mind also must have some high use and destiny. That use must depend on its place in the ascent and in the return, and that destiny must be a fulfillment and transfiguration, not a rooting out or an annulling. So this idea to descend from the heights of realization with a power that surcharges the nature below has to be part of nature's ultimate scheme for her to be justly revealed as the divine, in form, in power, in ideation. All of these things must continue. Mind can't simply be discarded because it's a tool of the ignorance. It must be made as perfect and as whole a complement to the whole being, as the life parts of us, as the body itself. No aspect of our being ought to be silenced, annulled, extricated from our nature. This also is a tantric goal. And Sri Aurobindo, of course, begins with a Vedantic basis in realization, but as he says, he will drive towards a tantric synthesis, where everything is brought together and made whole and harmonious. We perceive then these three steps in nature: a bodily life, which is the basis of our existence here in the material world, a mental life into which we emerge and by which we raise the bodily to higher uses and enlarge it into a greater completeness, and a divine existence, which is at once the goal of the other two and returns upon them to liberate them into their highest possibilities. Regarding none of them as either beyond our reach or below our nature, and the destruction of none of them as essential to the ultimate attainment, we accept this liberation and fulfillment as part, at least, and a large and important part of the aim of yoga. In other words, he's saying yes to nature. That's chapter two. Next week we'll begin chapter three. The threefold life. Tonight we'll conclude with a passage from Savitri early in the book. This is this is book one, the book of beginnings. This is canto three, the yoga of the soul's release. We're going to begin on page 23. This bodily appearance is not all. The form deceives. The person is a mask. Hid deep in man, celestial powers can dwell. His fragile ship conveys through the sea of years an incognito of the imperishable. A spirit that is a flame of God abides, a fiery portion of the wonderful, artist of his own beauty and delight, immortal in our mortal poverty. This sculptor of the forms of the infinite, this screened, unrecognized inhabitant, initiate of his own veiled mysteries, hides in a small dumb seed his cosmic thought. In the mute strength of the occult idea, determining predestined shape and act, passenger from life to life, from scale to scale, changing his imaged self from form to form, he regards the icon growing by his gaze, and in the worm foresees the coming God. At last the traveler in the paths of time arrives on the frontiers of eternity. In the transient symbol of humanity draped, he feels his substance of undying self and loses his kinship to mortality. A beam of the eternal smites his heart. His thought stretches into infinitude. All in him turns to spirit vastnesses. His soul breaks out to join the oversoul. His life is oceaned by that super life. He has drunk from the breasts of the mother of the worlds. A topless supernature fills his frame. She adopts his spirit's everlasting ground as the security of her changing world and shapes the figure of her unborn mites. Immortally, she conceives herself in him, in the creature the unveiled creatrix works. Her face is seen through his face, her eyes through his eyes. Her being is his, through a vast identity. Then is revealed in man the overt divine. A static oneness and dynamic power descend in him, the integral Godhead seals. His soul and body take that splendid stamp. A long, dim preparation is man's life. A circle of toil and hope and war and peace, tracked out by life on matter's obscure ground. In his climb to a peak no feet have ever trod, he seeks through a penumbra shot with flame, a veiled reality half known, ever missed, a search for something or someone never found, cult of an ideal never made real here, an endless spiral of ascent and fall, until at last is reached the giant point through which his glory shines for whom we were made, and we break into the infinity of God. Across our nature's borderline, we escape into supernature's arc of living light. This now was witnessed in that sun of force, in him that high transition laid its base. Original and supernal immanence, of which all nature's process is the art, the cosmic worker set his secret hand to turn this frail mud engine to heaven use. A presence wrought behind the ambiguous screen. It beat his soil to bear a titan's weight, refining half-hewn blocks of natural strength. It built his soul into a statued god. Well, we're in the season of the return to light. Appropriate that we would end with lines like these tonight. And I wish you a happy holiday season in this ambience of bathing light from above. And thank you. Namaste. Jai Ma.